my bed's on fire. Don't touch me, I'm a real live wire. Psycho killer.
This week in the studio, two Big Talking Heads anniversaries. We'll have David Byrne and Jerry Harrison speaking in tongues.
Watch out. You might get what you're after. Cool babies. Strange but not a stranger. I'm an organ picker.
Burning down the house.
Take me to the river. Dip me in the water. Wash me down. Wash me down.
Once in a lifetime. Water flowing underground.
Same as it ever was.
In a song, it's always the singer singing about their own feelings about something. They kind of interpret it through themselves, but in a picture you can just show it and say, here it is, make up your own mind about it.
I think the Talking Heads were one of the first groups that tried not to be about some fantasy that was bigger than life, but tried to be about being strong within a life that was ultimately real. And I think it's one of the reasons that we've had staying power, because we then were able to change as our life took us into different interests.
Hi, I'm David Byrne of Talking Heads with another of my true stories.
Hi, I'm Jerry Harrison of the Talking Heads, and I'm in the studio for the Talking Heads.
You know that there are popular bands, respected bands, influential groups, but then there are essential ones. In the Studio is always concentrated on the last category, and with their induction, in the very first year of eligibility into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2002, the Talking Heads transcended from being one of two groups, along with the Ramones, that actually redirected and reinvigorated rock and roll. When Rolling Stone magazine compiled the top 500 albums of all time, the Talking Heads placed no less than 4 on it. That's remarkable. It all started in 1974 when guitarist David Byrne and drummer Chris France, both art students at the prestigious Rhode Island School of Design, formed a band that they called the Artistics. After they enlisted France's girlfriend, Martina Weymouth, also at RISD, who had been driving the band around to gigs, and she started to play bass. With Byrne writing the songs, the trio soon found work in New York City at CBGB, the legendary New York punk and new wave club. The T-Heads actually made a name for themselves among the same circuit that at that time included Patti Smith, the Ramones, and Blondie. Changing their name to the Talking Heads, inspired, by the way, by Marshall McLuhan's writing on the pervasive influence of television, the Talking Heads toured Europe with the Ramones in 1976. They were so well received in England that they became regarded as an important band even before they had recorded their first album. That first Talking Heads record came out in 1977, but before they recorded it, they decided they needed a keyboard player. So they went looking for Jerry Harrison, a Harvard graduate and a founding member with Jonathan Richman of the Modern Lovers. Living in Boston at the time, Harrison remembers his first encounter with the Talking Heads.
They invited me to come down and do rehearse with them in New York. And actually, I was so broke that I had to get a job moving someone's furniture to New York to be able to pay for the trip. And they thought of me as a keyboard player, but when we packed up the truck, there was no room for my keyboard. So I stuck a guitar in and went down. I showed up, and they go, I thought you played keyboards. I said, I do, but I didn't have room to bring it. So went out for Chinese food, and we went back to their loft, and we started rehearsing about 1 o'clock in the morning, but it sounded great from that moment on.
My bed's on fire.
Psycho Killer from their debut effort, Talking Heads 77. Many people speculated that song was inspired by the infamous Son of Sam, who terrorized New York City in the late 70s. But Jerry Harrison explained that Psycho Killer had actually been written years earlier. In fact, as Jerry Harrison remembers, the song took on a different tone after Jerry became a talking head.
It was a lot lighter presentation before I joined the band. And I think that I was, maybe from coming out of the Modern Lovers, I saw that there was a heavier sonic approach that I thought could bring out, you might say, some of the insanity that the song suggested. That song was probably written in about 1974, 73. That was the first song they ever wrote. It was when they were all at school, at Rhode Island School of Design. Actually, what it was is they decided they wanted to write a song like Alice Cooper. And we were then once in Detroit, we met Alice Cooper, and he goes like, God, I'd have given anything to have written that song.
Talking Head 77, the album, spread the news that this new wave band, with its quirky lyrics and simple arrangements, were for real. At the time of its release, David Byrne felt that the Heads would fluctuate between a large cult audience and possible fluke mass success. That's his quote. It didn't take long, however, for the mass success to start taking shape. Bright and brainy, David Byrne nonetheless admits to finding Talking Heads' lyrical inspiration from Tolstoy to the tabloids.
Yeah, it was the kind of thing where I'd read them, and usually I'd read them in the checkout line. And
I think that's what everybody buys them, right?
Yeah, I'd read them in the checkout line. And then after a while, I thought, well, wait a minute, I'm having a lot of fun reading this. I'm going to take it home and finish it. And so, I kept going, kept reading them for a while. And I clipped some stuff, and friends would clip things and pass them on to me. And at some point, I even got so obsessed with it, I went and found people who had back issues.
Mm.
Can you imagine that? Somebody saving back issues of these things.
The Talking Heads released their second album, entitled More Songs About Buildings and Food, in 1978. It sold more than 500,000 copies and produced their first hit single, a cover of Al Green and Teenie Hodges' Take Me to the River. Here's Jerry Harrison.
We'd been doing it in person for years, for a couple of years. And it just seemed like a natural. It went over well with our audience, and we said, let's just do it. I think that one of the reasons that we got such a unique sound on that is that I had never heard the original when they said, this is a song we've been doing by Al Green. And I said, well, just teach it to me. And so David started playing a guitar line, and I then made up the organ part, which in a certain way is like the central, element in the recording. But I wasn't influenced because, we never do that kind of bent note like that Al Green and then when Brian Ferry did it that everyone else does, because I'd never heard that. And I think it's why our arrangement, it was very funny when that came out that year. There were three versions of Take Me to the River that came out that year. Levon Helm did it, Brian Ferry did it, and we did it. And ours was the most unique because of that. And so it just shows that sometimes it's really good not to listen to the record.
Thank you.
With the album More Songs About Buildings and Food, it marked the first time the Talking Heads used producer Brian Eno from the band Roxy Music, who had also produced David Bowie. In the years to come, this collaboration with Eno would prove to be very important. In 1979, the Talking Heads gave us their third album, Fear of Music. It was Jerry Harrison who explained where that interesting title came from.
Well, what it was is that we were just sitting around in the Bahamas when we had made more songs about buildings and food. And David was talking about a book he was reading about odd psychological difficulties. And one of the chapters was called Fear of Music. And I said, God, is that a great title for an album? And it just kind of stuck with us. And then we ended up using it for the next one. And I also designed the cover for that album, the kind of raised deck plate pattern. I thought it was one of the first, you might say, tactile album covers. Fear of Music, of all of our albums, is the one in some ways I was the most involved in as a writer. When I joined Talking Heads, most of the material for the first two albums had already been written. And after Fear of Music, when we did Remain in Light, then Eno and it was kind of more equal the way we were working and writing the music. So Fear of Music was the one place really where David and I worked kind of separate from the rest of the band. And so I was like a co-writer of Heaven and of Mind and Memories Can't Wait and, you know, sort of more involved in all of the songs as well as Life During Wartime.
David Byrne's paranoid look at international terrorism more than 20 years before 9/11. The song Life During Wartime was perhaps best known for the line, "This ain't no party, this ain't no disco, this ain't no fooling around." Up next, David Byrne and Jerry Harrison of the Talking Heads help us explore an album rich in African rhythms. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with David Byrne and Jerry Harrison in the studio. More songs about buildings and food for the best of the Talking Heads.
Hi, I'm David Byrne of Talking Heads with another of my true stories.
Hi, I'm Jerry Harrison of the Talking Heads, and I'm in the studio for the Talking Heads.
I'm Redbeard. The Talking Heads had two albums in a row that had gone gold and charted in the top 30. But with their fourth album, Remain in Light, they did anything but play it safe. Instead, Remain in Light was an experiment in unusual electronic effects mixed with African rhythms. With the help of the single Once in a Lifetime, Remain in Light reached number 19 on the album chart, but even more importantly, it underscored the Talking Heads' position as leaders in the emerging world music trend. Here's Talking Heads keyboard player Jerry Harrison with me in the studio.
I think that Remain in Light is one of those albums that, I mean, I'll always be most remembered for and that I always remember because it was the album that maybe influenced musicians around the world the most. I think that our listeners' appreciation of it, one of the reasons that it lasted so long is that other people being influenced by it made people go back and listen to, you might say, The Root. But it wasn't, Once in a Lifetime really never was a big hit here. It did very well in France and in England, but in the United States it was fairly marginal. And in some ways it was around the time of maybe Stop Making Sense, and then the movie Down and Out in Beverly Hills, that it got its next shot in the arm, you might say. And I think that's why people really remember it so much, not so much from when it really first came out.
And you may find yourself living in a shotgun shack. And you may find yourself in another part of the world. And you may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile. And you may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife. And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
Letting the days go by, let the water hold me down. Letting the days go by, water flowing underground. Into the blue again, after the money's gone. Once in a lifetime, water flowing underground.
And you may ask yourself, how do I work this? And you may ask yourself,
Once in a Lifetime from the Talking Heads album Remain in Light represents a quantum leap for the Talking Heads, what with Eno's electronic experimentation and its reliance on African rhythms. The change in musical direction had been hinted with a song on Fear of Music called I, Zimbra. And as Jerry Harrison told me, this change, of course, didn't happen on a whim.
Well, there was some there were some decisions made that caused it. And all of us had been into Fela and to Manu Dibango and some of the other African artists that we could find at that time. And we quite immediately recognized its connection, you might say, to American R&B, which when Talking Heads 77 came out, I used to always get these comments from journalists. There's something here. I don't know what it is. There's an influence. I can't quite figure it out. And we go, yes, mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't say anything. And then when we did Take Me to the River, they go like, that's it. That's it. And then we had realized making the last few albums that sometimes when we first played a song, there was something special about it. That in the first rehearsal, the first incarnation had a tentativeness sometimes and a innocence that when you played the song more and more, it got changed. Sometimes, of course, it got better, but sometimes there was something about that first rehearsal tape that you couldn't quite ever do again. And so we decided to make an album in the studio so that those first expressions of an idea would be caught.
In the U.S., the Talking Heads delved into new territory in 1980, music video. Their first clip for the song Once in a Lifetime featured David Byrne as a Mr. Rogers on acid. But even more paramount than the fact it was their first video, Jerry Harrison of the Talking Heads believes it had larger, more significant long-term ramifications for the band.
Well, it was a video that in some ways separated David from the rest of the band, which I think it's a brilliant video. And yet, because it only shows him, it was the beginning of people, I think, beginning to think of him out front of the band and separate from the band. But I think that up until that time, we were like a diamond on stage, that you were always aware of all of the facets, but you maybe one was turning more closely to you. And that as the show got larger, you end up looking at the singers more, and you end up having your eye directed towards the singers. And so I think that plus a couple of videos had a tendency, maybe was inevitable, but I think that separated David from us, and which I think, I have mixed feelings about it. I think it's a brilliant video.
Regarding the video or feature film medium, I asked singer-songwriter David Byrne of the Talking Heads to compare it with rock and roll.
Not so much in making a movie, but I think more in singing and performing. It's the kind of thing where I'm pretty quiet. I'm not real outgoing in my daily life. But then on stage, I kind of turn into the flip side.
That feels good, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's great. I mean, I can be as nutty as I want and run around and kind of have a lot of energy. And then I'm real quiet when I'm at home. It's not something I was immediately aware of, but it must be the same kind of thing where it's all the stuff that's kind of bubbling up inside kind of comes out on stage.
Speaking in Tongues came nearly 3 years after its predecessor, and with its sparse production reminiscent of their earliest albums, it went all the way to number 15 in national sales in America, propelled by the first ever top 10 single from Talking Heads, Burning Down the House. A cautionary tale about the dangers of excess and neglect to the physical body, I asked the normally shy David Byrne if music video and feature-length film afforded him a comfort zone in which to express himself more.
The one big thing is that you kind of get to throw everything together. You get to throw in music and pictures and acting and characters. You get to throw it all into one pile and make something out of it. You can also show stuff, whether it's people or places, that are real or make-believe real. And in a way, you're just showing it and saying, this is something that's out there. Have a look at it. This is either a person that's out there or a place or whatever. Have a look at it and either laugh at it or enjoy it or appreciate it or do whatever. In a song, it's always the singer singing about their own feelings about something. They kind of interpret it through themselves. But in a picture, you can just show it and say, here it is, make up your own mind about it.
What was the name? We walked away, but
Making Sense, the Talking Heads, originally from summer 1983 on the album Speaking in Tongues, now on the Best of Talking Heads with the song Girlfriend is Better. Next, David Byrne and Jerry Harrison returned in the studio to explore Americana by gazing through the spyglass lens backwards. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, and you can sure hear a lot more at inthestudio.net. I'm Red Beard, in the studio with David Byrne and Jerry Harrison, Talking Heads album, Speaking in Tongues.
Hi, I'm David Byrne of Talking Heads with another of my true stories.
Hi, I'm Jerry Harrison of the Talking Heads, and I'm in the studio for the Talking Heads.
Thanks again, gentlemen. I'm Red Beard. After the success of Speaking in Tongues, the Talking Heads released their second live album in 2 years, a partial soundtrack to the concert film Stop Making Sense. As 1984 turned into 85, David Byrne began working on a movie called True Stories, which chronicled everyday life in a fictitious Texas town. Byrne directed and co-wrote the film, and in doing so, inadvertently affected the direction of The Little Creatures and True Stories. Keyboard player, guitarist, and songwriter Jerry Harrison of the Talking Heads contends that as a result of David Byrne's fascination with mid-80s Americana, the Little Creatures' True Stories album period pointed out an important distinction. Here's Jerry with me in the studio.
And I would say that True Stories retained that idea, that it was, an exploration of Americana. And so you had songs, for instance, like Radiohead, which was kind of almost Tex-Mex. You had a song like Creatures of Love, which was sort of country. I think that those are two really, two linked records, but that are kind of concise song format, which show the fact that we are from America, not from England.
Now she's starting to rise.
reportedly a song about astral projection. That's the Talking Heads, originally from the album Little Creatures in 1985, with And She Was. In 1987, David Byrne won an Oscar for his collaboration on the film score The Last Emperor, while Jerry Harrison tried his hand at producing other musicians. Harrison also released a solo album right before the Talking Heads' eighth studio album, Naked, was released. And David Byrne actually wrote, directed, and appeared in the feature film True Stories in 1986.
I liked the directing part a lot. The acting part I didn't like as much. I felt like somebody else could have done that. I used the excuse that it wasn't really acting. It was just giving kind of nutty readings of my lines. I never had to break down and cry or had to get mad, never had to pretend to get mad and hit somebody or fight my way out of a firestorm or anything like that. So that part I was unsure of myself in, and the other parts I really enjoyed.
I've always felt that people like Woody Allen and Mel Brooks, they are, they're famous for their respective neuroses in film and in comedy. Actually, I think they must be the sanest people alive.
That's true. They can kind of exercise their whatever their personal quirks or neuroses or anxieties are, make it into a show and
someone will pay you to do it.
They make it entertaining to watch somebody be nervous or something. And I think in the end, they end up all right. They end up all right, and
I think
kind of gets it out of their system.
No wonder Time magazine was suitably impressed enough to let David Byrne actually design a cover for the prestigious periodical.
They said, well, we don't usually do this, but since we'd like to give you a shot at doing the designing the cover yourself.
It wasn't your
idea?
No,
it was their idea. What they said was, what we usually don't do this because this is like giving it away that you were thinking about putting you on the cover. But in this case, if we want you to do it, we kind of have to tell you in advance. It was really a shock. Apparently, it was the kind of thing where the band, for a long time, has been the kind of group that a lot of people have kind of discovered, or they've discovered it, or their friends have told them about it, or they maybe hear it a little bit on the radio, and it's something that they kind of picked up gradually.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like all of a sudden one day we had a monster
hit.
Right. And
that's true.
And we were a household word. The folks at Time, it was a kind of thing like this, like the different editors had maybe discovered the band or things that I had done or whatever, all at different times and at different places. And all of a sudden they all realized that they...
They've been closet Talking Heads fans.
Yeah, something like that.
All
yeah.
the time.
Yeah, something like that. And so they figured, well, hey, something going on here. Let's write about it.
Little toes. Now he's coming to-
The Talking Heads' hiatus after 1988's album Naked became permanent, but husband and wife rhythm section Tina Weymouth and Chris Franz recorded and toured as the Tom Tom Club. Jerry Harrison released solo albums, as did David Byrne, and the Talking Heads' concert film, directed by award winner Jonathan Demme, became one of the most successful in history. Jerry Harrison theorizes on why the Talking Heads were not just popular, but an important band in rock history.
One of the things I think that Talking Heads stood for was kind of sticking to your guns, doing what you did best and doing it, and where it took you and how whatever success it brought you, that's what happened. And I think that that was inspiring maybe to people who felt there's often been a fantasy aspect to rock and roll where the artists try to be bigger than life. They try to look like pirates. They try to look like juvenile delinquents. They try and look all of these images that are somehow, I'm the sexiest person alive. And I think that one of the problems with this is that a lot of musicians believe their press and believe this about themselves. I think it's why people get involved with, you know, drug excess and with trying to live this fantasy that a lot of people have about rock and roll. And I think that it's quite demeaning, actually, for the audience. I think the audience comes and sees that, and it's like you go to the audience, go to a show, and maybe your girlfriend seems like she's more attracted to the lead singer than to you anymore because he seems sexier, or basically it's a facade. And then you kind of vicariously want to live that fantasy for yourself. I think the Talking Heads were one of the first groups that tried not to be about some fantasy that was bigger than life, but tried to be about being strong within a life that was ultimately real. And I think it's one of the reasons that we've had staying power, because we then were able to change as our life took us into different interests.
I'm wearing my fur pajamas.
having placed no less than 4 albums on Rolling Stone magazine's top 500 albums of all time list, the Talking Heads were inducted in their first year of eligibility into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2002. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests, David Byrne and Jerry Harrison. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Red Beard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2018, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet, theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.